This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to this third special edition update of AMDA On The Go. AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care, moved quickly to develop and update guidelines for our practitioners and facility administrators, nurses, and staff. Given the fluidity of issues and mandates around the pandemic here in the United States, there continue to be a number of considerations around the management of COVID-19 in the post-acute and long-term care environment. Dr. Swati Gower, the chair of the Society Infection Advisory Committee, has been leading us through the evolving state of COVID-19 and helping us to learn about the management of this disease in the nursing facility. Dr. Gower is a fellow of the American Geriatric Society and a medical director of two facilities in Northeast Georgia. She has a master's in business administration and owns a number of companies focusing on innovative nursing facility models for efficient patient care, and she helps organizations create geriatrics-based service lines. Dr. Gower, again, welcome back to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Wayne.
Dr. Gower, you're continuing to comment on colleagues' concerns since our last podcast. As before, I've gone back through Twitter and LinkedIn discussions to glean some of the most common questions. So let's just jump right in. Has the Society made any additional updates to its guidelines on the management of COVID-19 within nursing facility systems and processes of care over the past week? You know, the president, in speaking about Kings County, Washington, in a recent briefing, commented on the nursing home setting being a focus of concern for COVID-19 spread. Are you finding that society recommendations continue to be aligned with those of the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, as well?
That's correct. So when we are writing guidelines or updating our guidelines, we are definitely looking at the CDC guidance that is coming out. And sometimes we are coming up with guidance really based on the experience of our colleagues all across the country who have been going through that. Several of our colleagues do work in not just in long-term care as medical director, but we also have colleagues who are ID specialists in multiple other settings, including Department of Public Health in various parts of the country. And we are gathering all that information, processing it, and finding out the best ways to do things to create some standards. And that is all going into putting the guidance in. Sometimes we get ahead of it, ahead of CDC and CMS. Sometimes we are looking at CDC's guidance for some things and adding them also. What we are definitely doing is ensuring that everything that comes through CDC as well as CMS is included and addressed in our guide.
And we should mention, I think, or if you could tell us a little bit about the, in addition to the guideline updates, there was a resolution that the society recently put forward. Can you give us some insight on that?
Absolutely. So this has been a work of a lot of foot soldiers in AMDA who presented this resolution. It actually came out of the California society that AMDA adopted. And essentially what it states is that facilities that are COVID-19 naive should not be forced to take a COVID-19 positive patient who is actively transmitting disease. This had become a concern because there was a 3-day waiver in place and there was some development that was being noticed that could have been perceived as if the hospitals were going to want to have the COVID-19 patients come to the facilities. Too much hangs in balance for the facilities that are COVID-19 naive. Therefore, AMDA has really supported us medical directors in saying that we should not be forced to take a COVID-19 positive patient into our COVID-19 naive facility. Further, AMDA has recommended that the government, working with multiple agencies and AMDA, find alternate sites for patients with COVID-19 because we do anticipate a surge of these patients and they will need to be admitted to a facility. And also, if there are any facilities who think or who feel like they could be COVID-19 specialized facility, they can possibly handle these patients. But it is a big relief for a lot of us medical directors who feel the pressure to take COVID-19 patients into our facilities when we don't have any. And that's where AMDA has really helped us. I know that AMDA is also in close talks with CMS and CDC to address these issues further.
What are some of the latest updates that you have been focusing on?
So as you mentioned, the CDC actually had come out with the MMWR report that is the early release that came out, I believe, around 19th of March or maybe a little earlier. And that report has looked at the Kings County facility that you had just mentioned. And one of the issues that CDC had brought up, or rather was in the MMWR, was that staff is, it's important to screen the staff and make sure that they are healthy. And of course, that had been put out in the earlier guidance. What we had added after that and have focused on our guidance in March 19th guidance is the fact that facilities should actually keep a log of where their staff is additionally working. And our facility, for example, based on that guidance, has created a spreadsheet of all staff that may be working in other facilities. And this is because the finding of CDC in Kings County was that some of the spread may have been contributed by staff who may have been infected and was working in multiple facilities. So that is one of the guidances that we had in the March 19th update. I just wanted to point out that we have updated the document twice now, and the more current update has some other new things that we have included, so a lot has happened since. As far as the staff is concerned, what we had we have now recommended is, since fever is not the symptom, not the only symptom that the staff may have, and several staff members may be really having minimal symptoms, we are recommending that the staff should wear masks to prevent their droplets from getting on the patients, or residents rather, in long-term care facilities if they are going to be going anywhere near that 6 feet of the patient.
You know, the greatest comment I've noted at this time continues to be around transitions. And it appears that frustrations are primed to escalate both on the hospital and the nursing facility side. You know, folks are suggesting that patients are tested and are COVID-19 negative prior to transfer. You know, my question to you is whether this is realistic. You know, are we now beyond basic screening? Is this going to create an unbearable holdup to the hospital? If patients are stable but COVID-19 positive and can't go to a SNF, you know, where are they going to go? And, you know,
yeah,
what are the latest considerations around this?
Sure. And I think this is a great burning issue right now. And that has been addressed in our most recent guidance. And the most recent guidance actually states that you have to make sure that you have a very robust admission process. We are seeing that the all across the country, the reports that we are getting is the patients may be coming through from the hospital and may have something as subtle as, you know, transfer for exacerbation of COPD. Treated as such, and they may have been found to have been tested positive for COVID in long-term care facilities. And by then, it is too late, unfortunately. And what we know is that the spread is very fast once you have an undiagnosed COVID-19 patient in the facility. So what we are recommending is that we have a robust admission process in the facility. So I can describe you what happened in our facility and based on the guidance, how we have changed it. So essentially we had a little questionnaire that we had created first, and we thought that that is going to suffice, and we gave it to our admission coordinator. And that questionnaire had fever or any respiratory symptoms, just ask the hospital if they have it. We soon realized that that was not going to be enough. Now the process that we have in place is that we have two independent staff members looking at the patient's chart and reviewing them. And they are essentially using the screening tool that we have put up on the AMDA website that has not just the fever, but common and uncommon symptoms of COVID-19. They may be something as subtle as drop in oxygen saturation. They may be something as subtle as needing excessive numbers of inhaler treatments, albuterol inhaler treatments, or even diarrhea. And the staff is independently looking at the patients and coming back, discussing those patients, and making sure that clinically these people seem to be free of disease.
Right.
We don't ask for COVID-19 testing because we know that the testing is not easily available and the turnaround times are high. So that's why we don't ask for COVID-19 testing for every patient. Because of the turnaround times of, you know, sometimes 7 to 9 days, even if we asked for testing for every patient, what would it mean 9 days later? If it was negative, because the exposure sitting in the hospital is significant. So that's why we are not recommending at this point to ask for testing for everyone. What we are doing is risk stratifying the patients by doing a clinical check in the review of record. If then you find somebody who has respiratory symptoms or who has these symptoms based on the screening tool, we are requesting the hospital to then test the patient. Otherwise, we do want to take patients from the hospital setting because we understand that the hospitals right now are also in, you know, getting to those surge capacities, and they will need to have patients who are not COVID-19 be sent to long-term care facilities. So we want to make sure that the process continues in a timely fashion. Now, since we are not having this diagnostic test for every patient, we are asking that when the patient is coming in as an admission, that the staff wear their PPEs. So essentially, they will be wearing their masks, their gowns and gloves, and we'll be treating this patient as if they may have COVID-19 for admission assessment. And then what we are recommending is that the facilities try to bring in the new admissions into a single room if possible and isolate them with droplet precaution for a few days for observation. And I know that with several shortages, this may be difficult, but if you're able to do that, that is a good practice that we are recommending.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
We're talking with Dr. Swati Gaur about the evolving COVID-19 picture in the post-acute and long-term care setting. Dr. Gaur, as an extension from the last question, and you may have actually answered this, but maybe a little bit more detail. The Annals of Long-Term Care just came out with a review around infection prevention and the focus that DPH will now be taking due to the CMS mandates around COVID-19 largely. Where should every nursing facility be at the minimum with regard to policies and procedures around managing and preventing infections? You know, what should be the status quo now?
The status quo really now is should be what the status quo should always have been, really, in my opinion. You know, there's an observation that some of us are making that the silver lining, I think, in this COVID-19 situation, and we can talk more about best practices, but it is forcing us to adopt best practices in a hurry. And basically, that means that your infection control policy should be followed to the T. Good hand washing. Every employee practicing adequate hand washing, you know, following the infection control practices, that should be happening. But those are not a whole lot different from the practices that are already in our policy books, policy and procedure books. CMS, in their guidance, which is actually available on AMDA website, does have almost a cheat sheet. Make sure that alcohol-based hand sanitizers are available easily. I know that I had gone to a facility and noticed that on the wall-based alcohol based hand sanitizers, somebody had decided to put clean liners for garbage cans. And of course, that would have been a tag.
Yeah.
So things like that, we need to make sure that we are following everything so that the staff can maintain proper procedures on hand washing, hand cleaning, and doing everything really to keep that patient safe.
A great time to strengthen the alignment between the medical director, the director of nursing, and the administrator, especially with regard to being able to oversee things that would be an obvious FTAG violation. So great advice, thank you. You know, I gotta bring it up. Personal protective equipment, PPE. It continues to be a main topic of concern. The White House administration has promised 1 million masks. Given the poor supply of PPE right now, have there been any changes or augmentations regarding the standards for PPE use?
So I do not remember if we had brought this up. N95 respirators are not really something that CDC is currently sticking to for long-term care. We are currently using regular surgical masks, and that should be sufficient. We need to practice good stewardship of our PPEs. And that means essentially make different levels of activity that will require different PPE. For example, our highest risk activity that happens in long-term care is albuterol and, you know, nebulizer treatments.
Right.
Nebulizer treatments cause aerosols to be generated, and those particles can stay in the atmosphere up in the air for about 3 hours. Those are high risk for transmitting disease to our staff members. The other procedure that is of risk is when staff is doing nasopharyngeal swabbing, because that may generate sneezing or coughing at a very close range. Mm. Other procedures like suction, open tracheostomy, maybe those procedures where staff needs to be careful. Since we have limited supply of face shields, we are basically asking the staff to prioritize and make sure that they're always wearing face shields during these procedures, along with the mask. These, I know several hospitals and health systems have come up with cleaning of these face shields and reuse. Mm. So we have seen limited reuse of some PPE. Of course, you never want to reuse your gown if it is the yellow gown for PPEs when you're going into a COVID-19 positive patient. How we have recommended the stewardship of PPE is now that we are asking the staff to be wearing a PPE with every single patient in the facility, what we are asking is, because it is really to prevent the staff's droplet from going to the patient, we are asking them to wear it from the beginning of the shift to the end of the shift. Mm. Do not touch their face, clean their hands several times, and essentially be able to wear that mask until the end of the shift and that single mask, because it's really for prevention of staff droplets.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, if a staff member is going into a respiratory isolation, high suspicion of COVID-19 patient, you want to discard that PPE and then start giving care to the others.
Yeah.
So those are the little tricks that we have come up with to conserve PPEs. The other thing that I actually looked at today is we are asking our staff to also, we have our admissions coming into an isolation setting. They do not have any symptoms. We are just keeping them for observation for a few days to see if they are going to develop symptoms.
Right.
When they don't have symptoms, the staff doesn't need to wear a full gear because the level of suspicion is very low. So while the staff is going to be wearing droplet precaution, we are looking at the second contingency in the gowns, which is washable gowns that CDC recommends, mm-hmm. so that we don't burn through PPE. So several options for trying to conserve the PPE.
And I'll just add a couple of comments on my own. I'm interested what you think with regard to gowns. It's not so much the donning of the gown, but it's the appropriate doffing of the gown. And my suggestion would be to make sure that there's some sort of in-servicing or reminders that people are actually taking off their gowns in an appropriate and safe manner. Is that something you have been seeing as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought it up. In fact, today, we have had the doffing technique of the gown, and it's interesting that every time we talk about the gown, we almost mime it. the doffing technique. So we do that, you know, some of us do that so that the staff remembers how to doff it off. So if you were able to see, you basically hold it away from your body right in front and you know, so on and so forth. So we literally mime that technique, and we have consciously started doing it because we want it as a reminder to the staff. The other thing today that I had noticed is noticed a staff member who was trying to talk to a patient, and I know that it is difficult for us to communicate to the patient through the mask, but we don't have an option right now to communicate, you know, for communication, just pull down the mask from your face, because that beats the purpose. So today we had a reminder that you got to wear your mask the right way, and there is a metal strip that you need to pinch on top of your nose to ensure that your mask is not getting displaced, because your droplets are going to come out through your nose and mouth. So very, very true. Good point, Wayne.
I also will add that I was recently asked to investigate the merit of cloth masks, and I did my own investigation that some of our listeners might find of value. The ultimate gist is cloth masks are a no, but there's actually a randomized controlled study in 2015 in Vietnam that ethics concerns aside looked at a good number of folks, cloth masks versus surgical masks versus a control group. Also information out of France and out of Singapore and out of China as well. And all showed that cloth masks were not suitable. They are not considered medical devices. They have porosity and pore concerns. 97% penetrance, whereas surgical masks have 45% penetrance. So for any of our listeners out there who have been asked to consider cloth masks with the under the aegis that they would be washed every day to make them better, not a good idea in this in the COVID-19 scenario.
I agree. I did not know the numbers for that. I had looked at WHO guidance, and they, as well as CDC, they do talk about cloth masks. I do know that a lot of places in health systems, they are frantically sewing a lot of cloth masks, and all across the country, actually. I've talked to multiple medical directors, and they have told me that they are sewing cloth masks. They are trying to make it those pleated cloth masks, but as far as I know, at least when I have talked to the hospitals, they are trying to conserve their N95 respirators and essentially thinking that they will be putting those cloth masks over the respirators. But I agree with you that there is evidence is limited. And in fact, the evidence doesn't point to benefit of a cloth mask.
Yeah, I have two more questions. The time we have remaining, I so appreciate your advice and your discussion. CMS has made some significant changes, as we all know now, around the use of telemedicine, and we're actually planning on having a podcast on the subject in the near future. But for now, it's almost like the telemedicine switch that everybody has been waiting for years has now been turned on, and we're all trying to accustom ourselves to this very bright light and opportunity of telemedicine. Just generally speaking, what are you seeing? How are we doing?
I think, again, going back to trying to adopt best practices, the situation with COVID-19 is almost making us adopt them in time lapse, you know. That is what I see going on. We are scrambling to all get telemedicine in our facilities. And the reason for that is, again, we talked about staff and staff transmitting. We have multiple physicians or clinicians who may be going from facility to facility. And to limit exposure, telemedicine is a really good idea. I know there's a lot of work that is going on that AMDA is doing with CMS, and they are in a dialogue to ensure that that regulation and waivers catch up. However, I think if you can have telemedicine in your building, you should. We have, one of the issues that we put in our new guidance is basically avoid any outside visits if you can help it, which means that outside consultants, it is, if you can avoid any routine visits, they should be postponed. However, even for urgent visits, if there are any visits that the consultant can do over telemedicine, it's almost preferable than sending the patient on a transport where they can get exposed and then sitting in the doctor's office where they can get exposed.
Right.
So it's really a very beneficial modality right now.
So to wrap things up, I saw that on LinkedIn, there was a comment about a report that the society president, Arif Nazir, put together, really talking about how COVID-19 is going to change the skilled nursing industry for the better. And our good friend, colleague, known leader, strategist, geriatrician extraordinaire, Mike Wasserman, is continuing to advocate for the skilled nursing setting and for the care of older adults. So, given what's all going on, what are you thinking about that we should be thinking about for the next week, weeks, or the longer term? What's going through your mind?
I believe things are changing very fast. If you are talking about just COVID-19, I remember there was a time when we were talking about let's make it that we were thinking that our goal should be that it should not be in our facility. I know that that reality has changed for several facilities, and today I had tweeted out, you got to be like a new driver. You learn the system, you learn how the car runs, but then you got to keep your eyes on the road because you got to keep looking ahead as to what could happen. I think this is not coming with an instruction manual. Yeah. We got to create frameworks of care and put things in place that would support those frameworks of care. For example, currently I have facilities that may not have COVID-19, but I don't know if I'm gonna be able to say the same thing looking at the numbers of long-term care facilities where people have developed COVID-19. What do you do then? The strategy, the basic, right things to do stay the same, but the strategy changes. Once you have a COVID-19 positive patient in your facility, what are your goals? And that is something that we address in our new update. What are the goals of the facility when you have the disease in your building? Your goals are two. Now you have to manage that patient's specific goals where you manage the patient. And you still have the goal to prevent spread. So then we need to start thinking. Today in our strategy session, we have to start thinking about what unit would we convert to prevent the spread if we did have that first index case. So things of that nature, you gotta start looking ahead. And also at the same time, you gotta look at what are we doing as a facility to minimize the risk of our current patients. So some of the tricks that we have come up with, or not even tricks, but best practices that we have heard from other people and also advocated is decrease your number of blood sugars. These are best practices if they are not needed. Discontinue completely the PRN inhaler treatments or nebulizer treatments rather. Because you don't want the nurse to say, I have a PRN when a patient has shortness of breath. You want that nurse to call you and say, this person wants an extra NAB and basically alert you that there may be something going on. And minimize the number of labs that we keep sending over and over again at this time. And for example, your hemoglobin A1Cs that were normal or close to normal 3 months back do not need to be done as clockwork every 3 months. You can push them out so that you can keep your patients with minimum contact with lab staff, et cetera. So, and then treatment in dealing with polypharmacy, patients should not be on 4 or 5 times medications schedule if they can come to 2, minimize the number of medications that we are giving. So this is a positive that is, almost a side effect that is coming out with this COVID-19 crisis, that we are really sharpening our skills to make sure that our patients are getting the best, we are giving the best practices, attention to best practices that our patients should ideally receive. So that's what I would like to say.
How fortunate are we to receive the wisdom and guidance of Dr. Swati Gaur, who is the Society for Post-Acute Long-Term Care Medicine Chair of the Infection Advisory Committee. Dr. Gaur, again, a work in progress, and thank you so very much for spending your time with AMDA on the go.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me here.
References on COVID-19 can be found at cdc.org, cms.gov, and of course the Society website, paltc.org. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this special edition of the Innovation Podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.